and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Anchorage Museum. Recorded on Wednesday, March 23rd, Todd O'Hara, Associate Professor of Wildlife Toxicology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Institute of Arctic Biology, presents Healthy Alaska, What's in Our Fish? That's coming up next on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans, after the news.
Thank you all for coming tonight. I did want to just start by thanking the supporters of this lecture series. We have a number of sponsors who have made this series possible in the three cities that it occurs in. The first is the INBRI program, which is the IDEA Network of Biomedical Research Excellence, and I'm actually the director of that program. And Todd is one of our highly esteemed faculty members, which is why I'm standing up here to introduce him tonight. We also have support from the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, the University of Alaska Fairbanks Center for Research Services, and the Geophysical Institute at UAF, and we really appreciate all of that support. So for tonight, you're going to hear a great story from Todd O'Hara, who's an associate professor of wildlife toxicology at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. As I said, he's a part of this statewide network of biomedical research excellence, and he's also a member of the CANR, Center for Alaska Native Health Research. Anyone in this audience who eats fish, Todd's going to be talking about you tonight. He's going to be talking about the benefits and consequences of eating fish and how nutrients and contaminants flow from these food sources. His academic training includes a Doctor of Veterinary Medicine from the University of Wisconsin at Madison, as well as a PhD in Pharmacology and Toxicology from the Medical College of Virginia, so you can see where he got his wildlife toxicology background. And he's also a diplomate of the American Board of Veterinary Toxicology. So his interests include understanding health of wildlife species and how nutrients and contaminant loads come through species that are also foods for other animals such as ourselves in Alaska, and particularly interested in subsistence food sources. And so with no further ado, I will turn things over to Todd.
Thank you, Jocelyn. I definitely appreciate the support's come down from Fairbanks and speak with you. We did this presentation in Fairbanks as well, and Jocelyn is also supporting me to wake up very early in the morning and fly out to Bethel, where I'll give a different presentation, but it relates very much to the same topic. Well, there I'll be talking about spotted seals and sheafish, because that's very important to that part of Alaska. And so I'd like to thank Jocelyn for her support in doing what we call outreach. And a lot of research programs sometimes fail to not support outreach adequately, but these programs do go to great lengths to make sure we can speak to the public and even get to places like Bethel and Barrow and Southeast. So Jocelyn talked about the programs we work for, and with programs have people, and so I'd like to make sure you recognize there are a lot of contributors to this presentation. I certainly don't do any of this totally on my own, and I've become more of a science manager than a scientist because we're training scientists, future scientists, and that's a very important role at the university. And Jocelyn mentioned biomedical research, and we're trying to get more scientists in Alaska trained in the biomedical professions, and that's how this project came to be. We have support from federal agencies to do this kind of work. The dilemma we're talking about tonight is sometimes known as the Arctic dilemma, but since we're in Anchorage, we'll call it the subarctic dilemma. The dilemma is that we have nutrients in fish. So fish are nutritious, Their consumption is vital to the well-being of many residents. Fish contain contaminants that pose a small but significant health risk to consumers. But of course, that leaves us with the question of what does this mean when you address nutrients and contaminants? And I'm going to try and help you sort that out. So Jocelyn mentioned if you eat fish, you're definitely connected to this talk. But even if you don't eat fish, I'm going to show you that you probably are connected as well. Fish touch us all willingly. I absolutely love fish. My family loves fish. My in-laws who are here love fish. So willingly, a lot of us take part in consumption of fish, but even unwillingly. And I'll show you how even herbivores, that is plant eaters, are affected by fish. They're very popular in subsistence and, of course, recreation. We have industries around recreation. They're valued as food from individuals, like I mentioned, for myself, my family, but all the way up to corporations. This is a big money-making operation, the amount of fish we can harvest, but also the image of Alaska fish. I can tell you that when you bring up contaminants with people who run corporations that depend on fish, they get a little nervous because that can really ruin the image of a fishery. Fish and wildlife depend very much on fish because it's a very important base of many food webs. So before I go too far, as a toxicologist, everybody thinks I have bad news, but actually we can present a lot of good news in some cases. So when I refer to chemical composition, we are simply implying the chemicals or chemical classes we measure in a fish. That doesn't necessarily imply good or bad, okay? We're just talking about the chemicals. They can be nutrients, they can be toxicants, they can actually be not very useful as nutrients as well. Marine chemicals or marine diet nutrients we're going to be talking about, those are the chemicals that or the nutrients that come from the marine environment that result from biological processes. Some of these are very important chemicals for us nutritionally, and some come from the ocean, and we want you to appreciate that. So the reach of marine fish, some of you may be aware of this, but it has been proven by science as well as how far this can go. Dr. Mark Whipfley at the University of Alaska Fairbanks has done a lot of work on freshwater biota and how salmon introduce nutrients to plants and animals in freshwater systems. Yes, plants. In the Copper River Delta and further upstream, the makeup of the plants has been chemically shown to be marine derived. So all those plants along streams and rivers are getting their nutrients from the anadromous fish, those fish that come back from the ocean. So when you look at the biological systems along rivers that have anadromous fish runs, you need to think of them as marine derived. It's very important to understand the amount of fish that come back presents a lot of nutrients to the system. Fish from the mouth of the Yukon River to Whitehorse, yes, the place in Canada, take up marine-derived nutrients. So the bottom line is salmon carry chemicals to freshwater resident fish. Marine chemicals can be detected in these fishes 2,000 kilometers from the ocean, again, in Whitehorse. So it's real important that when you think about fish, that we think about them in this way too, not just when we catch them in the ocean or catch them in bays. But Dr. Whipfley has done some research on the Kenai Peninsula where he's shown all these creeks and rivers and streams and lakes are connected to the ocean, and the salmon basically carry the nutrients into the Kenai Peninsula. Look at the network. I try to say this is like the vasculature system of an organism, that these are blood vessels carrying nutrients into the peninsula. And these are sampling stations where Dr. Whipfley and his students worked, and they found these marine-derived nutrients. The fish are bringing them into these systems. The other thing that Dr. Whipfley and his students showed was if the spawning density of the fish increased, this marine signature, we call this Delta N15, it's a marker for one of the markers we use for a marine signature, it increases and then sort of plateaus based on the amount of spawner density that occurs in those systems. Okay, and so it's really important to recognize that the amount of fish coming back can be very important to freshwater systems and those terrestrial systems that are around them. So when we think about salmon and nutrients and contaminants, we have to think on this scale as well, because the salmon and other fish that come up the stream are bringing those chemicals from the ocean, and it's getting into our terrestrial food webs. It's some great research, and it shows how the ocean and all the organisms within the interior of a peninsula are connected, and even Whitehorse. So healthy animals result in healthy foods in our state. That's pretty well accepted in this state, and that definitely supports healthy people and communities. And that's one of the main reasons we are doing this research. So here's a local food, and it's a local piscivore, or fish-eating animal, and it's a harbor seal. So we need to think as ecologists here. We don't want to just think about eating fish as being fish sources only. The fish-based contaminants and nutrients reach us by non-fish fish eaters, okay? So seals, whales, and birds are all pathways for fish-based nutrients and contaminants. This is really important nutritionally to the ecosystem, and it's important nutritionally to residents of Alaska. So when I talk about fish-based contaminants and nutrients, I'm talking about harbor seals, I'm talking about whales, I'm talking about birds, because they all derive a lot of their chemical composition from fish. And so when you start to think about the organisms in our state, you begin to appreciate many of them are fish-based, they're fish-derived, and usually marine fish. The other thing I like to emphasize about this work, and I already bragged about Jocelyn's perspective on outreach, is that we do this in a mechanism where we involve high school students and teachers, hunters and food preparers, and then the graduate students got cut off there. But the idea is that we work with the community to learn. So here's Darcy Holcomb, a graduate student, working with high school students about 15 feet away from the high school. And what we're doing is a hunter, who's out of the picture a little bit, is butchering the seal. Darcy's taking samples, and we call those necropsies. Veterinarians do necropsies. So we affectionately call this a nuturing. It's a butchering and a necropsy. And what is happening is the students are seeing, one, a subsistence activity take place, the butchering, and science happening side by side. This, we find, has been a very important learning experience, and we teach them about how the ocean is connected to their health. Sarah Moses did some work in Kotzebue, where sheatfish is a very important food for people in that region. So we make it relevant. We make the study relevant because it's food for the people in the community. If we weren't studying this as a food item, I think the community would be less interested in what we're doing. And so in this case, Sarah decided to look at sheatfish contaminants and nutrients. One thing to keep in mind when we talk about fish is, do people eat it with or without the skin on? The skin is actually a very important part of the fish that changes the chemical composition. If you prepare it for food with skin or without skin, it changes the chemical composition of the food, as well as what you actually do with the food. Do you eat it raw? I like it raw. Baked, dried, smoked. All these will alter the chemical composition. Unfortunately, what's been done in a lot of research to address food has only been the raw. The studies have been done on raw, and that doesn't necessarily relate to how people will prepare it for food. And so we just want to point out that in our studies, we try to make it as relevant as possible to the community, because we call this end of the fork analysis. We're sampling the food right before it goes in their mouth. I don't mean physically, I don't mean we grab it off their fork. But I think you get the idea that we want to address what people are actually consuming. So this can be very complicated, and these studies can get rather large because there are so many different kinds of nutrients we would love to study. There are the minerals, iron, copper, zinc. There's the vitamins like vitamins A and C. Beta carotene, good old vitamin A. Cholesterol, ooh, boo. Fatty acids, boo and yay, we'll talk about that. There's good fatty acids and there's bad fatty acids. Contaminants, I guess they're always boo, but sometimes they're at low levels that it's who cares. So that's what I'll talk about as well, is that we can address contaminants, But sometimes they're at low concentrations and we shouldn't be too worried. But there are cases where the concentrations might be of concern. So some of those would be heavy metals like mercury, cadmium, and the organochlorines, which some people know as PCBs, DDT. And so we'll talk a little bit about some of these. Obviously, I can't talk about all of these. I did threaten to stay here till 11 o'clock tonight, but I was told the lights would get turned out. The other thing about working with communities is you have to find motivated people. Find the people who make it happen. Motivated hunters. Here we were doing work in Barrow with my wife Carla. This is Price Brower. He's clearly motivated and he can be a motivator with a big knife like that. But this is a bowhead whale over here. And this is when we were in Barrow sampling bowhead whales with the same perspective. We're interested in the bowhead whale's health. It's dead, but I think you know what I mean. Before it died, its health status, the population's health status, as well as a food item. And Price was very happy to help us get access to samples. The food preparers, as I mentioned, are very important in understanding what people are actually exposed to. We need to know how the foods are being prepared and to get samples. So in order to do that, we need to consider the fish processing. So we have the raw tissue, we have to sample for the contaminants, sample for the nutrients. This gets really expensive fast. But then we have to deal with the processed tissues. Some tissues can be processed 5 or 6 different ways, like a fish fillet. There's many ways to prepare a fish fillet. And so we have to look then at the changes in the contaminants, the changes in the nutrients. There's the end of the fork where we're taking the sample from. This is an uncommon approach, but one we're trying to make more common because, again, it's more relevant to what people eat. And that's really one of our main targets, is to know what nutrients people are getting and what contaminants they might be exposed to. So some of the communities, they're basically, the food is at their doorstep. This is a subsistence. Their pantry is just right outside the door. And it's very important to respect that. So some communities along the coast are very dependent on marine resources. And here are some hanging out, I guess. This would be some salmon. Here are some marine mammal, mussel, more than likely a bearded seal. And this is the anti-scavenger device. That's if a gull comes along, it trips the trap, scares it. I thought that was pretty clever. So it's to protect their food from scavengers. But notice how dark that meat is compared to that. The marine mammal chemical composition is very different from the fish, and that's why we want to assess both. Even when we're talking about eating fish roe, that is essentially piscivory, that is consumption of fish. Many people don't realize that people eat roe. In this state, we know a lot of people that eat roe, but this is an uncommon practice that if you go to a traditional USDA or EPA-based website and look for information on contaminants and nutrients in roe, you won't really find that because it's not a common dietary practice in mainstream America. And so here's some more fish processing going on. So we have to address these things. And again, the processing is important. It's locally derived food. And the amount of food has to be considered. This is not going to the supermarket kind of purchasing or going to a restaurant. These animals are harvested in a very short period of time in a great amount and processed in these kinds of scales. Hundreds of fish for a family or a few families will be processed in one time a year and then stored for consumption over the year. And so this is my daughter Anna trying to show you the scale of just this one family's drying rack. So all these things are important to consider for how we use food in this state. I've heard a lot of Alaska Natives say the ocean is my garden, especially when people who think they shouldn't kill animals and eat them. I'm talking about animal rights activists. We'll say, well, why can't you eat vegetables? And we try to say, the ocean is my garden. That it's a different type of perspective, and it's also their fish market. So we can talk about hundreds of chemicals that are in these foods, but I'm going to just focus on some lipids, and in particular these fatty acids. And these are known as polyunsaturated fatty acids, or PUFAs. These are the very important nutrients that we find in some oils of animals. And these are highly marketed now as being nutritious. Then there's a contaminant known as mercury. But when we talk about fish and marine organisms, we're talking about methylmercury. So we'll talk a little bit about methylmercury. This is mercury. It's known as HG. And then this is the model for the structure of methylmercury. Mercury is widely used in many industries, mining, manufacturing, energy production, medicine, and dentistry. I know my fillings have mercury in them. And so you'll find mercury in many, many industrial processes, including medicine. It occurs in numerous forms, but I'll try to avoid a chemistry lesson and just say we're going to focus on this one because this is the one that's predominantly found in fish. But when someone's talking about mercury, you may want to say, well, what form are you talking about? And it makes a difference in how it's absorbed and its toxicity. There's inorganic forms, there's organic forms, there's many different forms of mercury. So all mercuries are not created equal. This form, methylmercury, is a known neurotoxin, and that's one of the reasons we are concerned about it and want to address it. So this is sort of some dramatic images of where mercury might come from. Obviously, it's a little overdone. But you can see in some cases, natural sources can be immense, absolutely huge. Yes, this is a volcano. Yeah, and these are smokestacks from energy production. This is a naturally occurring mineral, and that's elemental mercury. And so the reason I bring that up is because in the 1700s, this is an ice core. They were analyzing mercury levels in these ice cores from Wyoming, and they date the layers in the ice core. And so they got the core as deep as early 1700s. They were measuring mercury layer by layer, and they can date those layers. And you can see here's the level. It's about 2-3. It's cut off a little bit, but 2 or 3 parts per billion down here. And it's called pre-industrial. And then you can see the levels are fairly constant. And then Tambora goes off. That's a volcano. Well, that's a natural vent. But look how much it changed the mercury in that was deposited on that glacier. And then it comes back down to basically baseline levels. Then the gold rush happened. Mercury is a very common chemical used in the gold industry. And so in Wyoming, they had a lot of use of gold during the gold rush. And as you can see, then it came back down. Then Krakatoa went off, and huge spike in mercury. So note that these are natural events here. But then something strange happens to the baseline. It starts creeping up. And especially post-World War II, with the increase in industrialization. Then Mount St. Helens went, and you can see the spike that occurred on that. But it didn't come back down to baseline. So this is what has many ecotoxicologists, like myself, a little concerned about what are we doing to mercury levels in the environment. Have we increased the amount of mercury being released into the environment? This would hint that that's happening. And so why are we concerned about that? Well, we have this deposition of mercury into systems, and if it stays just as elemental mercury, or elemental mercury down here, it's not a problem at all. What happens, though, is bacteria, especially in freshwater systems, can turn it into that methylmercury I talked about earlier. But once it's this methylmercury in that organic form of what we sometimes call methylmercury, it easily enters the food web now. This form of mercury does not easily enter the food web. All you have to do is add a methyl to it, and now it's easily brought into the food web, especially the fish-based food web, and that's how it reaches predators like us. So it's this process in here that's important to understand, that the inorganic mercury is turned into organic mercury, and that's what then makes it available to fish, wildlife, and humans. And we call that biomagnification. It's going to increase from the small fish to the medium fish to the larger fish up to the predator. The concentrations in the tissues increase. And that, again, is biomagnification as it increases in concentration as you go up the food web. So in this state, it gets a little more complicated. We have fish-based mercury biomagnification. So obviously direct consumption of fish, it's easy to say, okay, well, there's mercury in fish, you eat fish, you're exposed. But what about consumption of fish eaters? It's less direct. So in this state, I already mentioned that we have seal that people will consume. But what about consumers of those who eat fish eaters? We have that in the state too. We have things that eat fish. You see how in this state we can suddenly start talking about mercury biomagnification having a greater potential? And that would be like polar bears, stellar sea lions. By the way, these eat harbor seals, if you don't know that. Large predatory fish, sharks. These all can be food for people, but recognize they're very high on the food web, and many of these have relatively high levels of mercury because of that biomagnification. So consumers of those who eat fish, eaters. I know it sounds a little strange, but we have these food webs. So a simple food chain that shows fish-to-fish transfer of mercury to humans are not appropriate. Okay, we need an Alaska perspective. So you will often see this, little fish, medium fish, big fish, person, look at all the mercury. Ooh. This is too simple. We need to have a better appreciation of it. Here's Alaska. We got, unfortunately it's cut off, but there's small fish down here being eaten by, I'll assume it's a humpback or a similar whale. And then you can immediately see the food web is a lot more complicated. The seal's eaten by the bear, which again is fish-based. There's people that eat whales like belugas and bowheads. You can see that the human consumer has a diverse diet and many pathways for these contaminants like mercury. Okay? These are all fish-based organisms. And they're all pathways for these contaminants and nutrients, like mercury. So this does not apply, in my opinion, in Alaska as much as this does. Now, for some of us, this may be the case. So mercury in fish, we got to understand, we have a better understanding of this, but how are we going to communicate this? This is very difficult to communicate. And we want to go over this a little bit, because this is one of the things we struggle with, is how do you go back to a community that's subsistence-based and try and give them reasonable information. Camilla Liske is a postdoc in our lab and a research professional, Maggie Castellini, the wife of the gentleman who's going to talk about the ship. It's a very small state. They're addressing mercury in food in our lab. And again, it's the raw and processed food. But it's based on concentrations of one's advice is impacted by numerous factors. So you got to think about a lot of things before you give advice. And I'll show you how we're trying to do this. But how would you communicate these findings to a community? I'm asking you for help. How would you go back to a community with this information? So here's what scientists love to do. They love to plot things. And we do them in rank order. Everything's nice and packaged and ordered. So these are our fish tissues with the lowest mercury concentrations all the way up to those of the highest. And we got to put measures of variability on there. This is based on, God bless you, Gesundheit, based on concentrations in fish. So total mercury in some Alaska fish. This is in parts per million. So this would be 0.4 parts per million here.
Well, wow, this is great news.
This is the United States Food and Drug Agency's action level. It's at one part per million. None of the samples reach that, and many of them are well below half of that. If this is the data I had, and this is the action level I had to use, there is no communication problem. So you're probably wondering, well, why is he bringing this up? Well, Canada chose a different limit. They chose 0.5. Well, now, Some of our fish are over that, and some of our fish approach that. But it's only halibut dried and sculpin boiled. Only a few of the fish, the rest of them are well below that. But again, that's based on concentrations in the fish tissue. But how about if we calculate what people are actually exposed to, what they consume? So a 70 kilogram person eating 100 grams of fish per day. So this is based on the amount of fish consumed. Okay, so we're going to change it to the oral intake of the individual. Well, this is what we like to call the no observed adverse effect level. Toxicologists love acronyms, NOEL. It's not Christmas. No observed adverse effect level. So at that level of exposure, no adverse effects were detected. That's a really important level to determine. Again, the concentrations in the intake would be well below what we would be worried about.
What units are on that graph?
It's cut off. It's on my computer. Part per million of mercury.
One question. What is sculpin?
Sculpin is a medium-sized predatory fish that lives a long time. Their head is bigger than their body, and these are we had three different types of sculpin that we had caught there, and one of them was called the belligerent sculpin. And I know why it was named that, because that was the one that always threw up on me when I caught it. And there was giant chunks of salmon in it. And so I didn't have to try and figure out what it ate. It provided that to me readily. Sculpins are, they have huge mouths and they're very predatory. So that's part per million. Sorry, I got cut off. But here's the Alaska intake criteria. Well, now you can see some of the fish are within that. That's probably manageable. Uh-oh, another federal agency. This is one from CDC. Well, their level's around 0.2. Uh-oh. Health Canada, World Health Organization, they're not helping much. It just seems to keep creeping down, doesn't it? So this is what the World Health Organization and Health Canada set for the at-risk population, which would be women of childbearing age. So now you can see our communication dilemma. We're now saying a significant proportion of the fish would be at a consumption level that these guys would say shouldn't be exceeded. Whereas we still have this NOEL out here. And then finally, the US EPA. Okay, and you can see that more than half of the fish and tissues and processing would probably exceed their recommendation.
We're gonna try our best to communicate this with communities, but it's gonna be very difficult.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Associate Professor of Wildlife Toxicology at UAF's Institute of Arctic Biology, Todd O'Hara. His talk on Healthy Alaska, What's in Our Fish, was recorded at the Anchorage Museum on March 23rd.
So it's not over, because some of us are of different statures and body mass, body weight. If you notice, we said the assumption was everybody weighs 70 kilograms. I hate to admit that I don't know the last time I weighed 154 pounds. I'd probably have to ask my mother. But that's the body weight that's used. Well, if you change the body weights of the people you're addressing, like maybe kids, or maybe some of us in our more mature stages, now you can see the consumption advice changes. Well, how are you gonna sit there and do these calculations for every individual in the community? And are they gonna tell you their body weight? So you can see how this becomes really complicated. What about variations in body weight?
One of the other things, we're just putting the Alaska criteria up here for now, is if you want to give good news, you say, well, eat halibut raw, but don't dry it for 100 gram serving.
So we also have to account for how the fish is processed. So here we're talking about halibut. We took these samples from the communities,
and you can see raw, fried, baked, and dried. And you can see how that relates to the consumption criteria. So it's very complicated. So we have a communication dilemma. And actually, I was down here not too long ago, and I met with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and the Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation to try and come up with a strategy. So we're working with groups to try and come up with a strategy to do this. So communicating the results is not straightforward. We have taken the route of presenting the data that give the context of the state of Alaska recommendations. That is, put it in what the state of Alaska has said might be the criteria to follow. But let the communities make their own decisions. I don't think we want to be in a position where anybody's mandating or being very heavy-handed in the kind of advice they give. There's definitely a need for better understanding of all the recommendations and the basis for those recommendations. One of the reasons those recommendations are all different for mercury is because everyone uses different, quote, safety factors, or they use a different study to base their criteria on. It would be nice if all those organizations agreed on one level. That would certainly help show some consensus. But as you can see, in our own federal government, we had a tenfold difference. FDA at 1, EPA approaching 0.1, right? I think you saw that. So even with our own federal aid government, we have a large disagreement on where the cutoff should be. Granted, FDA is interested more in commercial use. So are we alone in this dilemma? I'd like to go through a study in Washington State where they address this in from commercial markets. And these are not necessarily regional sources in Washington. Here's their data on mercury. Catfish has hardly any. The freshwater fish is basically fed grain, all the way out to tuna, which has got a reputation for, this is in part per billion, by the way, it's again cut off. I think everyone's aware that things like tuna and snapper tend to have higher mercury, and so do halibut. So their data was like this, not too different from ours. But they found PCBs in their salmon. Well, I'm very suspicious these were farm-raised salmon, because it's been shown in Science, that infamous journal, they published that farm-raised salmon had more PCBs in them than fish from Alaska, much higher. So you need to also think about the source of the fish. Is the salmon farm-raised or wild-caught? Big difference we're learning in the chemical composition. So I think they were dealing with farm-raised salmon. This is some fancy calculations. Concentration of fish to look at the doses, that the recommended doses from the agencies. And so I'm just showing you the formula. So what he did in communicating this, Dave McBride, is he then overlaid, I hope this is making sense. He used the mean concentrations he found in those fish to then say what the meals per month should be. And then this category would be unlimited. So this is the plot of that data for the EPA cutoff. But again, we have that FDA action level way out here. Okay, so it's very confusing. But this was an approach they took to provide people recommendations on a per species basis as to how many meals per month. So for subsistence users, these recommendations can be a big deal, because I think you can imagine they eat more than 3 or 4 meals a month for many species. It may not affect recreational users or commercial users very much. So we try to keep the advice in the context of who we're targeting. I put this up here again to show you that I think this is the farm-raised salmon. I'm very confident about that. Again, part per billion. And so salmon actually turned out to be the most restricted fish, about 6 meals per month, based on PCB concentrations. Now, this is how ridiculous this gets. The FDA tolerance level is 2,000 part per billion. I couldn't even put it on the graph. It's in the hallway. So their cutoff is 2,000 part per billion, yet we're giving consumption advice using other agencies' criteria down here on PCBs. And so this is the dilemma we face when we try to communicate this. So to summarize some of the species, you can see that for catfish, when it comes to mercury, it's unlimited. Unfortunately for PCBs, there is some limit. And you can see how the species vary, whether you're talking about mercury or PCBs, and the amount of consumption that would be advised based on Dave McBride's work. Only pollock came out to be unlimited consumption for both mercury and PCBs. So what's Dave McBride going to do in the state of Washington? I don't know. It's very confusing. And that's why we're concerned that people will overreact. For the state of Alaska, they provide guidance at two websites. One is a general fish consumption calculator, and the other one is related specifically to pike in the Yukon Coast from Delta area.
So I'd like to emphasize that we can use that. They have what they call the calculator, and this allows people to use a point system to try and figure out the best way to approach eating fish.
And so I'll let you visit that if you like. But I thought it was a reasonable approach because there's a lot of pressure from federal agencies or the state to do something. And this was the best that the state could come up with at this time. And they continue to monitor fish and try and improve this. So we have to strike a balance. And I want to end on talking about some of the nutrients. So I'm going to move into talking about positive things like protein, oils, vitamins, and minerals. We want to present this information together because these components occur in a diet together and they're consumed together. Scientifically, to study contaminant-nutrient interactions is very complicated. If you want to see how a nutrient might affect the toxicant and its adverse effect, those are really hard studies to do. And so we're very limited in what we can do there. We want communities to consider the pros and cons, not pros or cons. I hope you get the difference there. They need to balance the pros and cons, not choose one over the other, because it is a balance you're trying to strike. The fatty acids are very important nutrients, and so I'm going to focus on these to end the talk. They they're quite varied in structure, these lipids. Some of them are essential for life. We need them in our diet in order to survive. Some are considered non-essential because they're not essential for life. However, they've been shown to be health-promoting. That is, they promote health or they help prevent disease. It's really important to think about that some of these fatty acids actually can prevent disease. Some are actually considered harmful, like the saturated fats. So we understand fats a lot better than we did a few years ago. So the majority of these lipids are in organisms, and they are a part of the fish-based food web. Here's what they look like. They're essentially a chain of carbons. Some important components of this are, this is why they're called an acid. This is a carboxylic acid out here. But it's these double bonds here that are very important in whether something's going to have a certain function or not. This fatty acid will have a certain function. These are what we call unsaturated. And when we say polyunsaturated, that means there's more than one double bond in this chain. And this is very important in this why omega-3 fatty acids have been promoted to promote health, to improve health. So just try to summarize it a little bit. Saturated fatty acids, boo, not good, like dairy products. Fish, polyunsaturated fatty acids, marine mammals, those kind of oils, very good. Very rich in these PUFAs, polyunsaturated fatty acids. Okay? That's why we like to promote fish. To show you how they're connected with other things, they form these triglycerides. This is a separate fatty acid here. This is how they're stored in our fat, as a triglyceride. This glycerol backbone, we like to say, has three fatty acids on it. So you'll sometimes hear triglyceride used. And that means it has usually three fatty acids attached to it. Why is that important? Because some of these fatty acids are part of components that make up our cell membranes. They're that basic in their function. This is where how our cell membranes appear. This is the water-hating part of the membrane, the water-loving part of the membrane. So you can immediately see why fatty acids are important for these membranes, because they're a very important component of this inner part of this bilayer membrane. So it's something that simple that they help make our membranes. For animals in this state, we have to talk about blubber. So a lot of what I was talking about was just regular old fat or adipose. In blubber, for our animals that depend on fish, these fatty acids are very important based on location and the depth of the blubber. And in those animals, their energy, their thermoregulation, streamlining, buoyancy, locomotion. So these fats and these fatty acids that make up those fats are very important for the function of blubber. So we're not necessarily talking about us in that case, but the animals that we want to conserve in this state, many of them depend on blubber. So you got to think about that blubber as being fish-derived and how important it is. Again, these omega-3 fatty acids, as an example, they're what we call cardioprotective. That is, they help in heart disease. They may actually prevent heart disease. There's evidence now that they're anti-diabetogenic. It's a fancy word for prevents diabetes. This is very important. Neurodevelopment. The PUFAs have been shown to be very important for the fetus and the brain development and the brain development of children. And this has also been shown, these fatty acids, to ameliorate the adverse effects of some toxicants. So a quick story about a study. In the Seychelles Islands off the east coast of Africa, they depend a lot on fish. So a group from the University of Rochester went down there to study this population because they thought this would be a great population to study the adverse effects of mercury on children because they eat so much fish. They went down there, and the anecdote I'd like to share with you is when they looked at the concentrations of mercury in the women and in the children, their neurodevelopment scores, that is how they performed on certain tests for neurodevelopment, were better. Whoa, wait. You said mercury is a neurotoxicant. The children, their development should be decreased. It didn't make sense to the University of Rochester either, so they were trying to figure out, well, how could mercury be health promoting? Well, they went back and they analyzed a lot of samples and a lot of data. What it was, mercury was a biomarker for fish consumption. What was enhancing the neural development of the children were the PUFAs. How about that? They went to study a toxicant, ended up showing that the omega-3 fatty acids were enhancing the development of the children. I thought that was awesome. And there's many more examples like that where we need to be careful about the assumptions we make about these toxicants. They're still working on suggested intake levels of these fatty acids. We can get too much of them, but there's a lot of effort now to try and come up with what are the ideal intakes for us to promote health. There's a lot of research going on in that. The other thing to think about is the ratios of these fatty acids. We also want to think about other antioxidants that come from fish, like selenium and vitamin E. These are just as important as the fatty acids and are very health promoting. We also want to talk about how the foods are processed, whether they're rendered, and how much oxidation occurs during that process, because that can affect the nutrient levels. We saw a lot of vitamin A degradation in some of the samples when they were processed from the marine mammals. And so we saw more than 90% of the vitamin A destroyed. So the bottom line is healthy and abundant fish are important for healthy northern residents. I like to point out that our family enjoys and eats fish. We also, when we're in those communities that do it, we enjoy and eat marine mammals. These animals, remember, are fish-based. They're fish eaters, but in an indirect way, they eat seals and whales. I want you to appreciate how much of the food web out there is supported by fish. So, considering multiple nutrients and multiple contaminants occur concurrently, I think we need to think about that when we're giving consumption advice. Intake should be based on consumption rate, body size, and pregnancy status. You need to think about the person you're targeting. Meal intake of fish is not a single species in size. As I showed, that's very important to consider. You can see how the species of fish gave quite varied meal per month recommendations. Food preparation methods, we've shown that that's important. We have conflicting interests among commercial, political, and advocacy groups. Be very careful when you're getting advice from a group. look at what their mission is. Okay, that could be very important in whether you want to take their advice or not. And again, user context is really important. How important are those fish to those people? What kind of alternatives to fish do they have? Marine fish reach many levels of geography and feeding habits in Alaska. I hope I proved that. Pathways for nutrients and contaminants can be direct or indirect and reach broadly. Proper steward of fish and those dependent on them must include their chemical composition and the associated critical pathways. I think we need to understand how these nutrients and contaminants move through the food webs of Alaska, including how they reach people. Proper health considerations should consider both the benefits and the risks, not just one aspect. I think it's important that we keep a grasp on both the benefits and the risks when we have these discussions, because sometimes we can focus inappropriately just on one aspect. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. This week, you heard from Todd O'Hara, Associate Professor of Wildlife Toxicology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Institute of Arctic Biology. His talk, entitled Healthy Alaska, What's in Our Fish, was recorded at the Anchorage Museum on March 23, 2011. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.